I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Behind the Lines. I'm Arthur Snell. One of the issues I wanted to cover in this podcast is Britain's relationship with Europe and with the EU, and how that might change in the future. So to discuss that, it was great to speak to Jakob Öberg, who some people might know from Twitter. He's a Swedish professor of law, works in a Danish university, and is a really intelligent commentator on Britain's current relationship with Europe, with the EU, and how that might change in the future. So here's Jakob joining me from his home in southern Sweden.
Right, well, I am today talking to somebody that people on Twitter might think is called Jakob Öberg, but he is a native of Sweden, so the correct pronunciation of his name must be Jakob Öberg. Is that correct?
That's almost nearly correct, but you might have to work in your Swedish pronunciation a bit. But yeah, thanks, Arthur.
Well, welcome, and perhaps we could start by tell our listeners where you're joining me from and where it is that you work and your current sort of activities.
Yeah, so I do sit here in Sweden. So I live in Lund, in the southern part of Sweden, but I work on the other side of the border in Denmark as a full professor in European Union law. And I'm probably here because of my small kind of interest on Brexit and my interest for EU-UK relationships. So super happy to be able to talk to Arthur about this.
Yeah, well, thank you. And absolutely, for those who take an interest in the troubled story of Brexit and the post-Brexit scenario, you're somebody who's very much worth following, and you've published articles and so on. And I wanted to talk to you today mostly about the UK's current situation vis-a-vis the EU and the legal and sort of technical challenges that might face the UK in the future if it tried to gain a closer relation, and we could then explore there are different types of new relation. But perhaps we could start with the current legal status of the UK in relation to the EU. And I suppose what I mean there is compared to other countries with which the EU has a significant relationship.
Yeah, so then the problem, well, the UK is now, as I just post on Twitter the other day, legally and politically a third country from the perspective of the European Union, which means that it's sort of it's kind of outside most of the EU's policies and outside the EU internal market and the customs union, which means that UK legally legally, economically, and politically has difficult to access properly the EU's kind of internal market. And that's sort of like that's both a legal and political question, but that's definitely where we are today. And it's very difficult to trade with European countries if you don't have a stronger sort of like trading relationship, a stronger trade agreement. It becomes much, much more costly. You have to do customs formalities and all that. But it's a long story, but basically it means that UK has less good terms than, you know, for example, the EEA countries and, you know, even like Switzerland. And yeah, so the other countries close to UK, which are outside the EU, they have stronger like trading relationships also than the UK. So I think that's definitely clear that the UK is really have kind of negotiated an agreement, which is definitely not the best you can negotiate for sure. Yeah. But we can talk more about that, yeah.
Definitely. So if we were going to compare the UK to other countries, the status of its relationship with Europe, is it analogous, for example, to the relationship that, excluding geography for a moment, is it analogous to the relationship that Canada has with the EU?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, like, the UK has a similar kind of like, sort of like, still like a proper like trade agreement. It is quite comprehensive. So it's similar, to agreements that the EU has with Canada, New Zealand. I would say it's in that style. It might go a bit like further on some counts, but I think it would say that that's the closest, I think, analogy, as I see it in pure legal terms. And that doesn't make that much sense given, you know, geographical gravity that.
Yes.
The UK's closest like trading partner, you understand doesn't make that much sense actually.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, just to take an example, you know, you in Sweden are much further from Brussels than we are in England, and
definitely,
and we have these considerable barriers to trade. There are of course a series of structures in Europe beyond the EU that offer countries closer trading relationships. And some of these will be very familiar to listeners, but it might be worth quickly sort of going through those. So you mentioned the EEA countries. Tell the listeners, which countries are they?
Yeah, well, so that's Norway, Iceland, and Liechtenstein that are those countries. So they're quite small countries, and they are part of the European Economic Area. Switzerland actually was a bit like UK; they didn't even join the European Economic Area for, you know, I think political reasons and neutrality and all that. So they're also a bit like more outside. But you know, those are the three countries, and it's of course with all of these three countries, I would say they are comparatively rich. And you know they can even manage on their own, even I think without the European Economic Area, quite well. But you know, they still consider it worthwhile to join the EEA as a substitute for the European Union.
Yeah,
and they had similar like sovereignty discussions, like it was in the UK for the Brexit referendum about sovereignty, and they thought that, well, we're not going to join the EU, but we're still like, we want to have like this really like access to the EU internal market, so we chose this option.
Yeah. And then another case study which might be worth talking about is Turkey, which, if I'm not mistaken, sits inside the customs union.
Yeah.
So perhaps you could explain that distinction.
Oh, definitely. That's very complicated. I mean, I think Turkey has a customs union, and I think that might be worth, you know, talking about, because that's basically, I think, might be politically the easiest option for, you know, a new sort of UK government with Labour and all that to take the UK into that kind of customs cooperation. But the UK customs cooperation agreement with the EU is still quite limited, and it doesn't cover all products, which makes it a bit sort of ineffective still. And I think Turkey is not that very happy about that agreement, but it's not been like politically such a big thing that any other parties wish to renegotiate it. But it's at least they don't have to do all customs formalities for all products. So some products are excluded from customs formalities. But I don't think agriculture products are, for example, excluded from that. So that means that, you know, they can still be subject to inspections and all that, which makes it quite difficult for Turkish sort of, yeah, food products to go into the EU. Yeah, vice versa.
But Turkey is obviously a large economy, you know, in that sense is very different to, for example, Iceland or whatever. It's a very large economy. Yeah. It produces a lot of manufactured goods.
Yes,
And those move freely between Turkey and the EU?
Yeah, in that sense that, you know, they don't have to do like customs formalities at the border, those products, which I think is part of the big cost of manufacturing. But they're not part of the EU internal market. So it's still kind of like, there still comes some additional sort of like, could be some additional problems for those products to getting the same access as other EU products because they don't have this presumption of sort of equivalence, yes, which we're talking about, the presumption of equivalence, presumption of, yeah, that you know, in the EU, we have this principle of sort of mutual recognition, which means that if you have manufactured a product in a state and it kind of conforms to EU standards, it's supposed to be able to be sold in all other states. And that kind of presumption doesn't apply in relation to Turkey products still, because they're not part of the EU internal market for goods, for example.
Yeah.
So it's still, you know, and that would also be the same for UK if the UK would join like a customs agreement, which I think is an easy, you know, political, you know, sell in many ways. They still have to, you know, provide, you know, or agree with the EU on this like equivalence, on the kind of having like equivalent standards, that we are have equivalent standards, because the presumption in the EU would be that UK products do not conform to EU standards. So they can avoid sort of like the kind of customs formalities, but there would still be like this kind of need for having some kind of equivalence standards agree with the EU. Yeah, we can talk about that later, yeah.
So one question I would have right at the start about this would be, if we think back to the Brexit debate, the argument being made on the pro-Brexit side, an argument which I think is discredited now, but to remember the argument, it was that if we leave the customs union, we can make our own trade agreements, and that's a big bonus for the UK. Now, I think most people will now feel that the evidence has not borne that out. But out of interest, how does Turkey feel, for example, when the EU is negotiating a big trade agreement? How is Turkey's interest represented in that context, where arguably it's similar to the UK? It's a large country, it has its own economic interests, and it's not involved in those negotiations.
No, but it still have to kind of like accept those negotiations because they're part of the customs, sort of agreement. Yeah, that's kind of like, that's what would happen if the UK would be joining. I don't think Turkey, I don't know actually how that's felt in Turkey politically. I don't think that's such a big political thing in Turkey at the moment. But I think that from the UK's perspective, I think this is the sensitive issue. I think here everyone has to be kind of like, think about the cost versus the win. I mean, of course, I mean, if the UK would agree with a customs union agreement, they wouldn't join properly UK customs union, but they would join some kind of like customs agreement with the EU. They would also be kind of, they will be able to take part of the same trade agreements as the EU and like benefit from them, but they will not be able to conclude their own trade agreements. That's for sure. That's kind of like the whole point of having a customs sort of union. So that's definitely the cost side. And now I think that's not going to be that big problem in the debate, although Labour thinks that. I think that now, given how little, you know, UK has been able to, and you know, and how little this gives to the economy, I don't think that would matter that much. But that's reality, and I think that's, you should be, everyone should be really honest about this, like upfront in discussion, that well, if you join the EU customs union with an agreement, you will not be able to negotiate your own trade deals. That's one of the drawbacks. Maybe it's not such a big drawback, but we have to still be clear about what's in the game, kind of.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. A measure of honesty, which perhaps has not been there previously, would be beneficial. But I suppose, for example, if I was the the Labour Party trying to promote this idea, could you say that there could be a mechanism in which the UK could have representation as part of the future trade negotiations?
That's definitely possible. I mean, I think UK would not like have a vote like a member state, but it would definitely be able to probably be represented at least as an observer in the negotiation. I think they definitely would have like a voice. Formally, would not be able like to probably veto anything, or because they're not having a member state. But it's definitely possible to legally agree for the EU to have like a representative status. And I think that's kind of like, I think everyone is sort of like thinking that the EU is impossible to deal with, but they're not actually. Actually, in my opinion, like the Commission and the member states are able to. There are definitely several flexible legal ways for the UK to still participate in this decision, although they wouldn't formally have like a vote. They will still be able to participate and influence talks and discussions. So I think that's kind of like where, Labour would probably need some good EU lawyers to consult them in a way, because there's definitely a lot to be done here.
But that's very interesting, because that sort of nuance about the influence is I think not currently talked about. I wanted to go a bit further though, and if we were to put aside the political challenges in the UK, because to some extent that's outside anyone's control at the moment, what would be the practical steps if, for example, the UK wanted to join the EEA as a kind of first step to a deeper engagement with Europe's economy?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think that the practical steps is that that would basically be quite a lot of states need to agree to that. So that's kind of that's a big sort of like legal and political hurdle. So both, I think all the states in the current European Economic Area would have to agree to that, UK joining the EEA. And then secondly, all the EU member states would need to agree to have UK join the European Economic Area, because I think that would be done, as I suggested like recently in an article, that would be done by sort of a kind of a big sort of agreement between the EU and the UK, and I think the EEA countries as well. So it would be a very complicated agreement, but it would kind of be between the EU, UK, and the other EEA countries which are outside. So all of them would have to conclude an agreement which basically says that, UK will be joining this agreement and adopts all these obligations. I mean, the EEA, we should be upfront, honestly, about that. That's almost like joining the EU light in a way.
Yes. Yeah. So if and again, we could get bogged down in the domestic UK politics, but setting that aside, you've described a process which obviously involves a big number of countries having to agree. And it so happens only this week, your country, Sweden, finally was able to join NATO.
Yes.
Which, of course, it's not a bad case study, was held up for a year by Hungary on and initially Turkey and Hungary, and then finally Hungary. And I think most people would say that their objections were not in any way principled, but were based on a kind of attempt to leverage influence. So is it reasonable to believe that a similar obstacle might exist? That one individual country might see an advantage, maybe Spain with Gibraltar. You could think of any number of possibilities.
I think you have to be realistic that there is always going to be like rogue sort of EU states as well, you know, that are a bit like going amok. Normally they're pressurized into agreeing with things, even with Orban. You know, EU has been able to agree, you know, very significant, important deals, you know, with EU budget now. And although he's acting in the worst possible way you can imagine from a diplomatic and political point of view, still the EU has been able to do all these things. And, you know, even NATO couldn't stop either, because the political pressure of him is still quite large. You know, if the whole world is against him, I mean, it's still difficult to. But yeah, sure. I think, you know, similar states like Hungary, or I mean, like Slovenia is now, you know, turning into a bit like of a, yeah, I don't know what really kind of like state at the moment. I mean, of course, they can eventually finally say, well, we're going to leverage this and we're going to say no to UK on no principle basis at all. But I mean, I think they will be pressurized. I think it's more about getting, you know, a majority supporting UK rejoining. I mean, then you can pressurize the rest in a way. And I think, honestly, I mean, the majority of EU member states would be happy to, you know, have UK back either as a, you know, EAA or the EU. And I mean, also among the political leaders as well. I think it's more about, are UK really committed to do this?
Yeah. So we've talked there about EEA, and I guess for a lot of people, the disadvantages of the EEA are fairly clear. As you said, it is basically like EU membership, but without a seat at the table.
Yes.
So we should talk about the EU. Now, this might feel like a fantasy for some people listening. If the UK wanted to join the EU, it is often said that before we left, we had a great deal. We had a nice situation with the retaining the sterling and the so-called rebate.
Yes.
Now, it is often said that there would be no debate to be had about those, and also no debate to be had about freedom of movement within the kind of employment situation. What's your view on those? I guess the question about the currency, given that both Sweden and Denmark have their own currencies, that feels less problematic.
I think so too. I mean, I've written about this as well. I mean, what my belief here is that in reality, I think UK will be able to get some concessions in negotiations for sure, but this should not be their starting point, and it should not be the selling point domestically either. It's rather something that they could agree with the EU, you know, in transparent, you know, secret rooms that, well, we can get this kind of like concession. So it's not at all unrealistic that UK could get some concession. Definitely, they will probably be able to get a concession from the euro, because that's a bit complicated. You know, Sweden didn't join because of a referendum, and they are supposed to join legally, but they still haven't done so. And that's for political reasons, and they will probably never join.
Yes.
Because, I mean, the euro, you need to meet certain like stability criteria, and UK and EU could just agree to argue and say that, well, UK have not met those criteria, so they cannot join the euro at this moment.
Right. So you could have a sort of technical reason why it wasn't possible.
And I mean, I think that's, I mean, I would say so, because there are some like very sort of like UK people which are a bit like over the top on this. I mean, realistically, UK will be able to get some concessions, but maybe not all of them. You know, I don't think they will never get this concession of cutting out part of free movement.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
That's not going to happen. And that's not, I think, legally, it's not really a legal question. It's just a political issue. But the EU never agrees that kind of deal with a country, like the EU country. It never does and have never done. You know, they just see it as, you know, keeping the kind of the integrity of the internal market intact. So it's just not possible. I think that's what Maroš Šefčovič also said. I think it was 5-6 years ago in negotiations that that's our primary objective, to protect the integrity of the internal market. Yeah. Opting into part internal market is never going to be possible in that way.
Yeah.
So I think that's where we're at. And I think that, you know, but you know, the area of freedom, security and justice, which I'm working on myself, maybe it's not, I think it's not impossible that the UK would maybe need to argue a bit. Maybe they will need to join Schengen. I think so. For example.
Yeah. And so Schengen, perhaps just for some listeners, you could quickly explain what Schengen is.
Yeah, well, Schengen is really important. It's kind of an agreement on border control in the EU, which basically means that you can have properly free movement of people without, you know, use of passport and, you know, passport control within the EU, which also means that you can kind of, you're a part of it's a specific agreement, which is kind of like not within the EU treaties, but it's a specific agreement among the states. But now it's kind of like a part of the key, EU key that all states agree. And some states are outside the EU also part of Schengen. For example, Norway is part of Schengen. So that's kind of like, it makes, I think that the EU would insist on UK also joining Schengen. Because that means that, you know, that might be a sensitive issue, because that means that, you know, you don't have this kind of like strong control over, you know, immigration and like, you know, it means that you have less control over which people passes your border, basically. So it's definitely, I think Schengen might be sensitive, but I think it might be something that EU would actually say, well, you can't really go away from it, because that's core of what we are at this point of, you know, European integration. So, yes. And it, I mean, for a number of reasons, I really don't think it makes sense for the UK to object to Schengen. I mean, it's really, it doesn't make sense, I think, legally or politically to do, because that would mean that, you know, negotiations would, like, I think, be very sour, I think, if you...
So what about one of the elements which has been talked about in the context of free movement, which, of course, we had before?
Yeah.
So that's not it wasn't some special arrangement.
No.
But it is sometimes argued that different European countries implement this in a more kind of rigorous way, and that, for example, in certain countries, if you don't have employment, then actually the free movement doesn't apply. And I've had it said to me that, for example, in Belgium, you have to demonstrate that you're in employment. Is it? What is the sort of correct analysis of that? Because that could be a way to manage it, even if it doesn't. It's not an opt out, but it's a tool.
I think that, like, Belgium is when you spoke of Belgium as an example, have been, you know, they have been taken to court on the basis of this, and they had to change their sort of practice in this regard. And I think it's about the citizenship directive, the benefits you get out of that we're talking about at this moment. And I mean, that also, the citizenship directive is quite like all encompassing, that it also gives right not only to, you know, citizens within the state, but also, you know, to their family members, so part of the nationals as well. Quite extensive benefit. It means that you can go for 3 months to another state, and you're allowed to stay for 3 months without having a job to apply for a job, for example, which is quite like an extensive sort of, in a way, you know, possibility, which you don't have normally. And, you know, that you can't really negotiate away that possibility. So, for example, I think that, you know, Belgium has tried to do that and been taken to court. And I think that, you know, it's something that I would like to say that is possible to do this, but I think that the Commission is actually, in principle, going after specifically this kind of actions because they consider this is kind of key sort of things for EU law to work. Free movement is kind of key, so they would actually prioritize taking UK or other countries to court for this kind of practice. And they don't take all countries to court all the time. They're selective which actions they, because all the states are, violating EU law every day, 10 times. That's what happens in reality. So, this kind of like very open, sort of ways of, making free movement more difficult, they're extremely difficult to maintain. But it might be a way but I don't think, you know this better about politics, but I wonder if that's the right, strategy to sell it to, to the British people. Well, we're actually going to do that. We're going to agree to free movement, but we are actually going to restrict it in our own way.
Could I say we're going to take back control?
it just becomes very illogical. I think one thing I want to add to that, Arthur, and I think that's what we're missing a little bit, but that, and I think that also applies, you might have more questions about that, with dynamic alignment and all that, but, eventually, UK politicians, leading politicians, which also have to stake their career, I think, in going back to, having a close relationship with the EU, they would have to tell to the British public that, well, actually, we will become a rule taker, but this is a cost. This is a cost that is worth being paid to get back, for example, our economy, which is not in great state at the moment, which not maybe all other European economies as well, but, UK's economy could perhaps have been a bit better, but we have to become a rule taker for this to work, actually. We have to accept the EU rules. All kinds of deal with the EU will kind of always assume that, regardless if it's internal market, EAA, if it's a smaller deal on veterinary SPS, all of this will always require that UK accept in agreement with the EU to take on EU rules and to implement them. So yeah. I think that's a cost that you have to be transparent about.
Yeah, it's a basic question. So let's talk a bit about, you mentioned there this concept of dynamic alignment. And the first thing that might be expected, which is really quite unambitious, but it is possible to believe that it might happen, is a SPS veterinary agreement under a Labour government. So perhaps you could you explain what that would be?
Yeah, well, I mean, those are a bit like technical, but SPS is about, control of, it's about control of food and food inspections and about, food products moving, easier between the borders. It's about so I think what this is about is that these are kind of like businesses of the UK where, it would be quite easy to find an agreement with the EU for this. And I think, to be honest, Arthur, I think the EU would be actually interested in doing this under this, condition that I mentioned, that UK agrees, and I think Labour is still unclear about this, to accept, EU rules. But this is going to take some time to negotiate this agreement. It might even take 1-2 years because it's still kind of complicated additional agreement to the TCA, to be both if you want to veterinary qualifications. It's still, all of them are quite complicated. What would be covered within it? Which kind of goods? How would it work? And I think, and I'm going to be honest here, I think that the UK doesn't need to have, supervision for European Court of Justice or a commission, but they will need to agree that we will adopt EU standards for this to work. That's kind of big. They would have to adopt EU rules. And I think that's, again, even with the smallest minor agreement, Labour cannot, avoid this thing. And I think here, I think they really need to become more straight to the public. I just read today on this shadow secretary for Labour statements that made me just a bit depressed because it's kind of well, we're going to try to, work with managing divergence and we're going to try to restore, trade negotiations with, Canada and I'm maybe you should actually honestly be a bit more serious about your clear your closest geographical partner. And so I don't know where they are. I think they're super, they're very ambivalent also within the party, of course. That's how it is.
Yeah. Although, I mean, I think you're absolutely right about the honesty point, but also, polling experts, the best pollsters in the UK seem to say that there is increasingly a majority acceptance. There is certainly a majority acceptance for levels of alignment and accepting that as part of the, part of the long-term initiative. I mean, there is on paper a majority for joining the EU, but whether or not that majority would translate in votes. But one of the things, when we talk about dynamic alignment, what this means in practice, presumably, is like if for some reason a new regulation comes into place in the EU regarding food because of some dangerous chemical or whatever, that we would immediately adopt that in our own system.
Yes, so it would become UK law as like in a quasi automatic way. That's how it works in the EA country. So it's not even like it might not even be like a regular sort of vote in a parliament or long negotiations. Would rather be like this is proposed to the parliament, and you have to accept it because you already agree with the EU to accept it.
And this is what they used to, as kind of dismissively, call the fax machine in the Norwegian context. I think it was this idea that the fax from Brussels would arrive and it told you what your next law was going to be.
I think it's a bit like this. It is. And I think that Norwegians are not always super happy about, how things work. But I think they're rather unhappy that they're not sitting at the table. I think that's their problem, that they would like also to decide, but then they would have to be, full members of the EU. So, I mean, that's a bit like, I mean, I wrote that. I just read, the other day when I was writing about the customs, that like a report from 2016, I think it was developed by Cameron's then before, the Brexit vote, Cameron's government. And, the government just said like, well, actually the best option, like customs union, internal market, like EEA, all of them are like worse options than staying in the EU. It's interesting reading. Like, there was a long UK government report saying, well, actually the best would actually be staying in the EU because then we would have a vote and it would economically also be the best option. So we're like, okay.
Yeah. Well, of course, a lot of people agree with you, and probably most people now, well, almost certainly most people in the UK agree with you, but we are where we are, as the expression goes. I guess one thing, though, because this idea of rule taker, think for a lot of British people with a, perhaps a kind of post-imperial self-importance, it's a bit difficult. But equally, it seems to me that, is it not true that you can decide to stop being a rule taker, but you accept that the consequence is that then you lose the access.
Well, so that's the thing. I mean, you're not, and that's of course how it is. You're not a rule taker forever.
Yeah.
Just because you agree with the EU, and that also means that that can be like, but you can also agree, terminate an agreement, for example, with the EU to not be a rule taker anymore. So it's not a permanent deal, and even the EU is not a permanent deal either. I mean, you can,
we've proved that you can leave the EU. So it's not. So the idea, because this is where I think, that obviously a lot of people on the Brexit side of the argument, they make this, they talk about independence and imperial, the EU is an empire. And of course, the difference in a classical empire, the subjects don't have the choice, they can't choose to leave, that's not an option. So I think it's, you're right that the politicians need to be honest about being rule takers, but they also need to remind everyone that these are choices that we make as a country that we could also unmake.
Yeah, of course. And I mean, it's a voluntary agreement, which means that you can also, it can be negotiated for a specific period of time or a permanent, but you can always terminate agreement if it doesn't work for you. And I think it's still a bit of freedom. I mean, and I think that countries joining the EU are not doing it because they think they're going to lose all the rights. They're doing it because they think that maybe like if we join, we can take more part of the benefits and economic enterprise and free movement, we can like, it's actually good for us to kind of pool our sovereignty in like, you know, the EU, which is kind of like still, I mean, very much governed by the member states. So, I mean, like, yeah, if you're a state in the EU, and I think UK had a huge influence on the EU when it was actually a member, so you can definitely, you know, influence a lot of things. And I really can't still understand how UK could walk away when they had such a good deal with the EU. Yeah. With all, like, exceptions and all that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing.
So I guess in the sort of final part of this discussion, maybe if imagine that we have a Labour government, and Jakob, your phone rings, and it's David Lammy, and he says, I'm appointing you my special advisor for EU reintegration. Congratulations. What would be your recommendations? Because where do we start? Because I guess for a lot of people in Britain who regret the Brexit, regret what's happened, and they know it's a long journey, that they know that this isn't something that could change overnight, but they'd like to know what the path might be. What would be your advice? And I'm talking really from a technical perspective, because
I think technical perspective, I think the easiest, both like legal and I think political as well, is to, you know, both do these kind of deals with the EU, like SPS and Metronome. I mean, they're good suggestions, really. They're like, and I think they're like well thought through, like, you know, ideas. And, you know, actually, I think EU even wants some of these deals. And, you know, they want deals with, you know, free movement for young people. I mean, that can be seen as discriminatory, but EU would like that. You know, they would be happy. So you start with that. But, you know, you talk to the EU, you go to Brussels, you talk with them, you know, guys. Tell us, you know, we have this problem in our industry. We really like to have a close relationship. Do you think it would be interesting, this kind of deal? We will accept, you know, undertake, you know, accept your rules, but we really want to have this deal. Do you think it could be doable? And, you know, the Commission and the EU says, yeah, why not? Let's do it. Let's start negotiating. I think that's, you know, that's how you start. And then I think at the second point, which is maybe a bit more complicated, but I would try to have a customs agreement with the EU to join the customs union, because that's politically also easier to sell. I think that's really where I think Labour vastly misunderstands the public opinion, because the customs union was never that sensitive from the start, to be honest. It was never, and it's never been politically such a hot potato. It's not free movement and all that. So it's about, you know, making things a little bit easier for business exporting. I mean, it's not taking away all problems, which means, but, you know, it's make it a little bit easier. And I think it will win, you know, sympathies, I think, from voters and, you know, the general public that to do that. But, you know, I think one problem here, Arthur, is I will have to say to David Lammy, well, actually, you will have to communicate immediately differently to the general public. You can't go out day after day and say, we have these red lines and we're not going to do anything. We're going to do managed divergence. I mean, if you communicate like that, you are going to lose credibility if you change the message the other day, next day. I think that's very dangerous, I think, for Labour to have this kind of like way, because they can't now, you know, go on a path to rejoin. They can't go on a path for the EAA. It's not going to be possible for them politically. I know this. I mean, they already like, you know, if you do that, you lose all the credibility. And, you know, I talk to people on Twitter the whole day, like, well, they can, you know, when they go into government, they're going to start rejoining, you know, it's not going to happen, because, you know, they promise, you know, everyone, they're not going to do that. Yeah. So, you know, it's, they have like, you know, they're stuck themselves in like a, kind of like a, in a corner where they are like, kind of have so limited options. So they have to start communicating a bit differently. Like, you know, study Khan, like the mayor of London did the other day. It was not very controversial things he suggested. It was something about the youth deal and all that. But, you know, a little bit different, you know, outward communication from Starmer, from Lamy, from Reynolds, or all those people who, you know, are like really standing for what Labour is doing. You know, I think there is a vast, I think there's a huge kind of like discrepancy here, because, you know, there's a pro-European, you know, part of Labour which are not very happy with what's going on at the moment.
Yeah, definitely.
So I would suggest, I would really love to have this one. I would say, yes, well, you have to start to send a different message. We're going to be like nuanced, but, you know, it needs to be a bit more positive towards the EU.
Yeah, because in a way, what you're saying is that the messaging from Labour feels like messaging from 2016-17 rather than 2024, where public opinion has moved quite a long way.
Well, I know, there's, of course, huge benefits maybe of having a Labour government from a political point of view. Of course, I also agree with that from a personal point of view. But, you know, they still, like, from an EU perspective, from, you know, having a better relationship, you know, with the EU and all that, they need to deliver something else and need to, like, you know, they need to, like, send a different message than what the Tories are doing at the moment. Because the Tories, to be honest, like, you can have all your views, points about Rishi Sunak and all that, but, you know, he's, you know, actually changed course from being, you know, completely destroying relations to actually, you know, striking, you know, pragmatic deals with the EU. So if that's, you know, that's good for the EU, you know, that's also, like, been, you know, that he's actually improved, really. That sounds like, you know, like, yeah. But he actually proved a little bit relationship, which we were before, which were terrible with Frost and Johnson. So, I mean, so what is the difference now with Labour if they come into power? What would it do different than what Sunak is already doing? So, I mean, that I think that's a question that you know, you might want to ask us, well, if I become a European advisor, or, like, ask also the leadership, I think.
Yes. Yeah, that's a great point. So, because at the moment, functionally, Labour are really adopting the identical policy to the Tories.
Yeah. In Europe. And I mean, it's not necessarily like a bad policy, but if you want to, you know, if you want to do something about the economy, if you want to have better relationship with the EU, if you want to, like, maybe be a bit more, like, listening to what business, you know, wants and people wants, you know, having, like, bit, like, feeding in their views, you need to do something different, I think.
Yeah. Well, I feel that's a great place to stop this discussion. I hope that the phone does ring for you, but I'm sure you've got other things you're doing in your life. But in any case, thank you very much for sharing your ideas with us today.
Thanks, Arthur. That was a lovely talk. I had a lot more to say, but we'll stop there.
Well, there'll be many more opportunities, I hope, in the future. You'll come back.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Behind the Lines. If you enjoyed it, share it with someone, or give us a good review. Behind the Lines was produced and presented by me, Arthur Snell, and the theme tune is by Matty Benbrook.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.